This morning, I want to look at you at Jesus alone. What does it mean for you to be alone with God? What comes to your mind when you think about that? Do you think it's a scary thing? Do you think it's a holy thing? Do you think it's something to be desired but really difficult to achieve? Looking at Jesus on this earth, we see him alone with his father a few times. And the first thing we see is that being alone with God for him was prayer. Prayer. That was his natural form of communication. It was his natural way of being with his father while he was on earth. It didn't have a list. It didn't have a set of needs. It was a way he was with his father. And so this morning I want to look at what it meant for Jesus to be alone with his father. And there are three prayers that we're introduced to, or not introduced to, we're privileged to be let into. That intimacy between the Father and the Son. I don't want to look at the content of the prayers. There's so much there. It's rich. It's wonderful. But I really want to focus on the context of these prayers. How were they happening? Where were they happening? When were they happening? What was going on around when they were happening? Because while the prayers themselves are interesting and wonderful, except one of them where we don't actually know what was being said. Why and when and how and what was going on when he was praying, I think are really instructive. So the first one I want to look at is in Matthew 14. And in Matthew 14, we're introduced to this idea. Well, not an idea, a fact. John the Baptist had been killed. John was Jesus' relative cousin. And not only that, not only that physical relationship, that family relationship, but he also had the spiritual relationship in that John was the forerunner. He was the one who was coming to declare who Jesus was to prepare Israel for the Messiah. And he had been killed, had his head chopped off at the whim of some little girl who was being manipulated by her mother, who was manipulating a king. And doesn't matter why, but John's head was cut off and John was dead. And the disciples came and told Jesus. And it says in verse 12, disciples came and took the body and buried it, and they went and told Jesus. Now, when Jesus heard this, so Jesus is having a reaction now. I just want to say something about that. Jesus having a reaction. Jesus was God. And so he knew everything that was going to happen. Not only did he know everything that was going to happen, he had planned everything that was going to happen. So there's no sense that Jesus was surprised by this event. Now, this may seem a little non sequitur. I have two cats. Tyler is 14, coming on 15. And Misha, who's a little psycho cat, is coming on 13. So they're kind of getting to, you know, end of life, cat-wise. Tyler, the older one, has arthritis, can't do the stairs really well, leaves little presents all over the house, and we think we'll maybe have to put him down soon. Now, I kind of know that, you know, cats live 15 years. That's the normal lifespan, and they're going to die. So I have this knowledge. I know that's going to happen. But when I have to put Tyler down, probably within the next year, I don't think that I'm going to go, oh, well, we knew that was going to happen. Yeah, it's fine. I also have parents who are 84, and in the normal course of events, if the Lord doesn't come, they will die soon. I know that. I don't think that knowing that insulates me from the emotional impact of Foreknowledge is not some guarantee that you won't feel anything when it happens. Jesus knew John was going to die. Jesus knew how, when, where, but when it happened, there was a reaction. He felt it. It affected him. And it says, now, when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. When Jesus heard that John had died, he didn't go, yep, that's the plan. He withdrew. He pulled away and went to a desolate place by himself, it says. And again, this isn't really the core of the message, but I think there's something here. We have to be okay with being affected. We can't be philosophical about the things that happen around us. If the Lord could be affected by something as simple as something that happens in the natural course of life and allows himself to be affected, you see it with Lazarus too, when he weeps. He allows himself to be affected by it. We have to look at ourselves and we have to look at others when they react to circumstance and recognize that that is part of the life of God, part of the intent of God. So he goes away to this desolate place. And thousands of people follow him. Like how annoying is that? You want to be alone. You ever been like that? You just want to be alone and you need to be like by yourself. Sometimes even your wife like just go away. I just need to be alone just for a few minutes. And anybody that's laughing at that, you're going to be in trouble later. But you just want to be alone and process things and think things through and feel what you feel without people looking on and all that. And it's bad enough when one or two people show up. Imagine if like 10,000 people show up, which is what happens to the Lord. And the Lord's reaction, I think, is very remarkable. Here he is coming away to grieve. That's his expectation. I'm going to be alone and I'm going to grieve. And instead, this crowd show up. Now, in Mark's gospel, you read that he took his disciples with him. For another reason too. Not only did Jesus want to grieve, he took his disciples with him so that they could rest because they had been so busy that it said they didn't even have time to eat. They had been so busy in the Lord's work. And I think there's another lesson in that too, and I'll leave you to infer what that is. So here they are now, and Jesus teaches them. He says they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he could have went, off you go. I don't want to talk to you. I'm too busy. I'm hurting. Off you go. But it says that he saw them and he had compassion on them. And I just find that hard as a lesson. When things don't go the way I expect, especially like as a total introvert, when I want to be alone and other people and like get in the way, how do I react with their needs and all of that? How do I react? Do I have compassion? Do I engage them, or do I just go, pfft? Well, to be honest, mostly I go, pfft, which is why I say this is such a lesson for me. I don't know if it's a lesson for you, but it's a lesson for me. And so this is like more therapy than a message, but that's okay. But after this, Jesus, all the disciples come to Jesus and say, hey, look, we've got like a lot of people here and they're going to get hungry and that's not good. So we should feed them, send them away. And Jesus performs this miracle of feeding the 5,000. And It says again in Mark's gospel that after he had done this, the people were going to make him a king. This was such a remarkable thing that had happened. And now it seems to the disciples, this is exactly how this should go. You were going to come and be the Messiah. Some of them knew that. Some of them weren't so clear. But now the people want to make you a king. This is brilliant. This is, you should do more of these like feeding things because it really works well in terms of getting people on site. And it says immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side. Now I want you to note two things. One is this was not the disciples' idea to get into that boat. He made it. It says he made the disciples get into the boat. There was a danger that the disciples were going to get swept up in this ferment of opportunity. 10,000 people, it's a lot of people. You could get a movement going here. And immediately he made the disciples get into the boat. And not only does he make them get into the boat and send them to the other side, there's a storm coming that he knows about. And he says, and then Jesus dismissed the crowd. Not the disciples, Jesus dismissed the crowd. And after he had dismissed the crowd, so again, you can just imagine a hillside. You can see the lake down the bottom and the disciples making their way down and into the boat. You can see the people start to disperse and go to the villages. They've been fed. They start to go home. It's evening. The sun's starting to go down, but it hasn't gone down yet. It's not dark. And there's a quiet that descends on the hill. You can hear it. You can hear the breeze. You can hear the wind on the lake, the waves lapping. It's quiet. And he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. There's a lot happening. On the one hand, there's a grief in his heart. On the other hand, there's the joy of having ministered. And on the other hand, there's the plight of the disciples who have now been sent into a storm. And it says, when evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way off, a long way from land, beaten by waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking in the sea. So I want to stop there. First of all, it was evening when Jesus dismissed the crowd and went up in the mountain to pray. So the sun's starting to set, that golden hour, you know, beautiful time, maybe 6, 7 o'clock in the evening, maybe 8. It goes to the disciples in the fourth watch of the night, which is between 3 and 6 a.m. So let's be generous and say it was 8 o'clock at night. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 1, 2. What does Jesus pray about for 7 hours? You ever tried to pray for a long time, especially at night? In fact, I find if I try to pray for any length of time at night, suddenly it's morning. Because there's no greater soporific than prayer. What does Jesus pray about, though? I mean, think about this. What occupies his mind for 7 hours that he has to pray for 7 hours? You know, we can imagine things that would occupy our mind. We can imagine things that would drive us to our knees. They tend to be crisis events. Things that draw our, we can't think about anything else, and all we can do is take them to the Lord. And even then, you know, filling up 7 hours, it's kind of, you know. And we learn something here about prayer. We don't hear what he said to his father. We just know that he did it for a long time. That prayer is first and foremost relational. It's relational. He is the Son of God. His prayer is not, please fix this thing or make this thing better or my disciples down there are going to be in trouble. They're in trouble. They're rowing, but it's not going well, and they think they're going to die. Can you help them? It's nothing like that. It's not even intercessional, because you're going to do something later that fixes all that. This prayer is a prayer of relationship, and that really hit me when I was reading this, because I have my lists, and there's nothing wrong with lists. I'm not decrying intercessional prayer. I'm not decrying resource prayer. Lord, I can't do this. Can you do this? I'm not decrying this, but I don't spend a lot of time in relational prayer, which is, I'm really enjoying talking to you, and I don't need you to do anything. I don't need you to fix anything. I'm just enjoying talking to you, because God knew how Jesus felt about John's death. He knew the joy he was feeling about the ministry he had performed. He knew the concern he had for the disciples. There was no need to rehearse that before God, because Jesus was God and knew his Father, knew all that. This was a conversation in relationship. And I struggle with that. I don't know about you. I struggle with that. I like my lists, and I get through them. But here's the other thing about lists. When you have them, sometimes you just want to get through them so you can go on to something, what, more important. Like, I'll pray, I'll get through this, and I'll do this, and then I'll move on. And sometimes you hurry it up because, you know, you've got, you something to get to, or places to be, or people to talk to, or you're busy. And so prayer becomes like this. Yep, did that today. And that's not how relationships work, is it? The affection, the time spent is important. I mean, you try this if you're married. Try this with your wife or your husband. So I'd like to talk to you. How does tomorrow at 7:30 work for you? Okay, excellent. We'll meet at 7:30. If you've got anything to say, please come ready to say it. Because I've got till 8 maybe. And then you sit down and you talk to each other for that half hour, and you say all the things. Oh my, you look particularly wonderful today, which is the kind of formal language you use with God. And, you know, try that with your wife more than once, and you'll get smacked around, especially at 7:30 in the morning. And then we just kind of, and then we say, okay, well, that's good. That was a wonderful conversation. I'll see you tomorrow at 7:30. I'm busy. Don't talk to me the rest of the day. I've got things to do and places to be. And, you know, if we're around, oh, well, yeah, you've got your thing, I've got my thing. That is not how a relationship works, except with God, apparently. But here we have the Savior doing, having this relational conversation with his Father. The other thing is, while he's having this conversation, the disciples are like dying in a boat. Like, they're just like, ah, we're dying. We're not going to make it to the other side. We didn't want to come tonight. We knew there was going to be a storm and it looked bad. And you made us get in a boat, and here we are, and we're dying. And Jesus just lets them worry for a while. Says he came in the fourth watch of the night. So for a number of hours, while his disciples were struggling, with his full knowledge, Jesus felt it more important to pray with his Father. And that's the question: what distracts you from prayer? What distracts you from time with the Lord? Life and death didn't distract him. Birds on the bird feeder can distract me. And I hate to say it, but it's true. Is you're going on and oh, look, there's a bird that can distract me. So that's one thing. What can distract us? The other thing is, from the disciples' perspective, where's the Lord? Like, don't you care? Doesn't it bother you that we're dying, we're drowning out here? The Lord lets them go through what they're going through. He lets them go through it for hours till they're convinced they're dying. not to be cruel, not to be difficult, but because he's going to show them something about himself that they wouldn't understand unless they had gone through this. If Jesus had let them stay with him, they would never have experienced the storm. If Jesus had just gone poof and suddenly they're the other side, they would never have experienced the storm. They go through it. And at the end of it, when Jesus comes to them walking in the water, they say, "Truly, you are the Son of God." They had learned something about him through that awful experience that they wouldn't have experienced or understood had they not gone through it. And sometimes we go through things and we go, "Where's God in this? What is God doing? Like, he doesn't seem to be anywhere. He doesn't seem to care. He doesn't seem to be doing anything." He's revealing himself. But he's not revealing himself in the way that we want him to reveal himself, which is as like our get out of jail free card, which is, "Lord, I have this thing going on and you need to fix it." And these disciples went through that while Jesus was praying because he felt it was more important to spend time with his Father than it was to rescue his disciples. And at the same time, teach them something about himself. When we go through awful things, and we do, we go through terrible, awful things. And sometimes we don't see the end of them. Sometimes we don't see the purpose in them. Have confidence in this, that God is doing something. And the fact is, he's not rushing to our aid in the way that we want him to or expect him to is not an indication of his lack of concern. He is before his Father right now. And I can't think of anything more important or absorbing than the presence of God. That's where he is. That's who he is. And he's also revealing himself to us in our circumstance, in our trial. In John 17, the Lord prays again. And in John 17, one of these grand prayers, the Lord has just celebrated Passover with his disciples. And now Judas, who's sitting with them, is actively engaged in his capture. The Lord himself tells him, "Well, you know, whatever you have to do, go and do it." So he's sent Judas out to actively betray him. I couldn't think about anything else. That would fill my head. I couldn't think of anything else. I can't believe he's doing this. He followed me for years and I called him and he's been with us and now he's doing this. Not only does Jesus commission Judas's work, but after that has been done, he enters into this prayer. And it's a remarkable prayer because it's mostly concerned with the disciples and how they're going to react. And not only how they're going to react, but what they need. They need to be one. They need to be unified. They need to be glorified. And if you know something bad is happening or going to happen in the future, sometimes that's all you can think about. It becomes an obsession. It becomes like an all-consuming, like I can't think about anything else. And here's the Lord, knowing full well he's going to be arrested, knowing full well he's going to be tortured, knowing full well he's going to die. Not only that, he's going to suffer. And his occupation in that moment is his disciples. I find that inconceivable. It's the way I'm wired. I can't think about other things when something awful's happening. It's not in me. But here's what the Lord is teaching. The most important thing is not you. The most important thing is that you care for, encourage, and support the ones whom God has put into your sphere. His disciples are listening to this prayer. Now they're kind of oblivious to what's going to happen next. But his concern is them. And there's something about prayer that elevates us outside ourself. If in the first instance we see that it's relational, I think in this instance we see that intercessional nature of prayer that lifts us outside ourselves, lifts us outside our circumstance, and focuses our head, focuses our mind and our attention and our desire on the best of others. The last prayer we read of that we're going to talk about tonight, I mean, I know it's the last prayer. We read about a prayer of Christ on the cross, but in Gethsemane. So, have you ever been afraid? What do you do when you're afraid? Yeah. I think fear is one of these things when you're a child that it's probably more prevalent because you don't have any control and you don't have any strength and all these things. When you get older, fear takes on different forms, doesn't it? But sometimes we're afraid. What do you do with that? When Jesus comes to Gethsemane, he says, "My soul is very sorrowful, even unto death." There's a fear. Now, I don't want to qualify that, but I want to explain that. What makes us afraid? We don't know what's going to happen next, and we think it's going to be bad. We don't have the resources or the strength to deal with what's coming next. We know what it is, but we can't fix it and we can't deal with it. The Lord doesn't have any of these challenges. He's God. He created the heavens and the earth. He knows what's coming next. He has the resources of heaven at his command. So he's not afraid for any of the normal reasons that we would be afraid. But here's the thing. Sometimes you just have to do something and you know it's going to be awful. Like, I have to stick my finger in the fan here. Like, this is going to be truly awful. And as the Lord anticipates the cross, it's not with this joy. There's a joy. He dealt with it for the joy that was set before him. He endured it, but it was awful. And thinking about what was coming, knowing what was coming, knowing that not only was he going to experience the torture and the injustice of official Judaism in Rome, but he was going to endure the suffering of the cross, not nails and spears, but the judgment of God. He was going to deal with that. And he knew exactly what that was because he was God. And it was horrific, horrific. It is something to fear. And he comes to his father and says, "My soul is very sorrowful." And he comes to his father and he says, "Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me." Not a prayer of make this go away. This was a plan that he and his father had worked out in eternity. This was the best possible way forward. If there had been another way, they would have figured that one out already. But this is the expression of the heart that is in fear, knowing I'm going to do this. Nevertheless, not my will, but your be done. I am going to do this. There's no question that I'm going to do this. He says later that the flesh is willing, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. I'm going to go through this. I know why I'm going to go through this. I agree that this is a right thing. But oh, this is going to be awful. And he comes to his father and just pours out that fear. He doesn't ask that, he knows this isn't going to be better. He knows that God isn't going to fix this because he's God himself and he's actually worked on this plan and had purposed this in eternity and wanted this to happen. But he prays, he repeats himself. Isn't that what you do when you're in fear? Like you can't stop it. You just repeat, I don't want this to happen. This is so hard. I don't want this to happen. Sorry. Please stop this. There's nothing wrong with that fear. For some reason, we've convinced ourselves as Christians that fear is somehow antithetical to being a believer, that fear is wrong. That's nonsense. Fear is a natural response to something. Here's the Lord in fear. What does he do? He pours out his heart. He pours out that fear. And I want you to notice one thing as we finish this. At the end of his praying, his attitude, if I can put it that way, has completely changed. At the beginning, he says to the disciples, "My soul is very sorrowful, even unto death. Remain here and watch with me." And he pours out his heart to his father. Nothing has changed. Judas is still going to betray him. He's still going to be arrested. He's still going to be flogged. He's still going to be crucified. He's still going to bear the sin of the world. And he's going to die. But at the end of this, at the end of this time of prayer, he says, "Rise, let us be going. My betrayer is at hand." What a difference that prayer has made to the Lord. Not that it's changed the circumstance, not that it's made everything all better, but it's strengthening. It's strengthening. There's courage that comes from prayer. Not because the source of distress has been removed, not because everything's been made okay, but because he is now connected with his father and he's reminded himself of who his father is and what he's set out to do. And as we look at our prayer lives, you know, just think about these lenses. Prayer is relational. Spending that time with someone who you love. Not because you want something from them, but just because they are and you love them. You know, prayer is intercessional, that this is not about me. I have this opportunity to bring the needs of others before the Lord. And prayer is strengthening. The Lord doesn't have to make everything okay in my life and make me comfortable and happy. But spending time with him gives me the courage to go into the things that he's prepared for me and to accept that this is his divine and sovereign purpose and it's best. It's not best in any particular moment, but it is best for me. So that's just a few thoughts as we think about our time alone with God from his son. Maybe let's just pray. Father, we thank you for this time we've had to spend with you in your word. What a wonder it is to see your son, God himself, in communication with you. And we who are his creatures, to be privileged to look on and to realize that he desired this time as well. He needed this time. Father, help us. Prayer's the hardest thing maybe we ever do. Help us to have hearts that are moved beyond ourselves and to be captured with the wonder of being your children. We thank you for this. Amen.